Hello there and welcome to Breakfast All Day. Your eyes are not deceiving you, neither are your ears. All four of us are really here for the third week in a row.
Oh my God.
What are the odds?
That's like 12 reviews.
It's insane. And we have a completely jam-packed day full of reviews for you. We've got Alita Battle Angel and Isn't It Romantic and Happy Death Day to You and Fighting With My Family. And we're going to catch up with High Flying Bird and we're going to talk about True Detective, but we're going to start with movie news. With the movie news that if you are in film Twitter, if you follow film Twitter, your feed has consisted of this, the completely boneheaded decision on the part of the Academy to take four categories at next weekend's Oscars: cinematography, editing, hair and makeup, and live action shorts.
And best actress.
one of the shorts.
Yeah. And they're going to show them during, they're going to present those during commercial breaks,
right,
cut them down, and then air them quickly afterward.
Right. Now, the Academy has recently said, so this news broke
a few days ago. Well, the announcement was last year without categories or specifics, but they were going to do
it. And then they announced which ones last, five, 6 days ago. And then as part of the backlash or response to the backlash, the Academy has said, well, we're not going to cut the speeches short. They're going to be aired in their entirety. It's just that they're going to do them, which
it's not going to be live. We're not going to see them live.
Which seems a little weird because then at that point it's like, okay, so then what's the point?
Well, you're cutting down the bringing somebody on to say
the walk to the
cinematography is such a vital part of filmmaking and the announcement of the nominees and somebody walking to the stage. And I don't think you're totally right, but I, of course, could be wrong. They didn't guarantee that they wouldn't cut down. They might cut down some of the thank yous. They say they will have the essence of the speech.
Yeah, but that also means they're going to be cutting the clips of the nominees. And I think that's a moment that means a lot to people in terms of if you're the person making the film, obviously, it's sort of your moment on national TV. I think sometimes it will maybe get somebody at home to be like, oh, that looks cool. I need to see that movie,
Right.
And I think that, as a lot of people have been saying on film Twitter, I think for a lot of us, when we watch the Oscars as kids, it's what got us interested in film, or at least understanding how films get made and what all the different pieces of it were and what the different departments do.
Right.
And so this seems ultimately pointless because the idea of, our numbers are declining every year for the Oscar show, but if we could make it a tight 3 hours, then
people
they'll come back in droves.
Right. People won't watch because it's 3:26.
You either watch the Oscars because you care and you want to see all 24 categories get presented, or you're not going
to
watch.
But also, there are no good categories to omit. I can't think of a single one.
No.
But, cinematography and editing are completely fundamental elements of filmmaking.
So
how do you get rid of
without
those?
Them, their radio.
Right. I mean, that was Guillermo del Toro's point on Twitter the other day, was where he very eloquently said basically that those are two parts of the art form that don't come from a theatrical tradition or any other artistic tradition. Those, in his words, are really cinema itself.
They're intrinsically cinema.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I've read some reporting that this is something that the Academy leadership is doing without checking with the various branches, because in the past, when this has come up, the kind of below the line branches or some of the smaller branches will vote together to remain part of the show, and this was done without that consultation is some of the reports I've read.
Yeah.
And there's a massive backlash. I mean, you mentioned Guillermo del Toro, but so many filmmakers, so many cinematographers, so many actors. I mean, name a branch of filmmaking, and they're complaining about this as well.
There was a big letter signed by Spike Lee and Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino, among other people.
Yeah,
and they all going to go? They're
going to
go.
Cuaron, Christopher Nolan, Michael Mann, Iñárritu, Del Toro, and now Clooney, Brad Pitt, De Niro, Elizabeth Banks, Peter Dinklage, Kerry Washington have all joined it as well.
I mean, does that matter, though? Will the Academy – there's time. I mean, we've got a week and 2 days. Will the Academy change its mind, do you think, because of this backlash?
I think that the focus of this argument is – the word Academy is being overused.
Okay.
This is almost certainly the American Broadcasting Company.
Right, that's true.
As Mark Harris pointed out, Disney is not nominated in any of these four categories.
So, it's
coincidence.
It's Disney's concern, and I was at the day that it came out, or I think hours after that it came out that the cinematographers should be included was last Saturday, and I was hosting the American Society of Cinematographers award show.
Wow.
So Matt Oswald and I added it to the monologue with John Bailey right there.
Yeah, I'd say John Bailey, Academy President, had to announce this in the first place.
And so what did John Bailey say?
Well, I mean, first of all, the joke was solid, so I'd like to repeat that. That was, the Academy so honors cinematographers that this year they're going to give out the Cinematography Award during a commercial break. That's actually true, right? To which there was some grumbling, and then we pointed out that it was odd that ABC decided to blame years of declining ratings on Haskell Wexler. But Bailey has said, it's worth mentioning. First of all, he's in an unwinnable position, right? Getting pressure from ABC to reduce the time of the show when he's been for years getting pressure. Everyone at the Academy has been getting pressure to include more categories. Like, sure. Why is there not a stunt category first and foremost? And it's going to rotate. So next year, these four will be back in, and four others will be out. So there'll be a cinematography Oscar that you can see the nominees next year.
But there won't be supporting actress, for example.
It'll be whatever categories Disney's not nominated in that particular year.
Yeah, and that all of these, at least the people, I guess I'm going to use the terminology wrong, on the board, the representatives from those branches agreed to it this year. They sort of volunteered, like, we'll take the bullet the first year. But nonetheless, the reaction is the reaction, and it would seem, I think Alonzo's point is the best, that you can't save the Oscars by turning it into you can't save the declining ratings. The Oscars don't need to be saved. The Oscars are an important thing for people who care about movies, and it takes as long as it takes. Or not important, but it still takes as long as it takes.
Sure, absolutely. If you're going to do it.
You can't turn it into the SAG Awards, which start at 8 and end at 10.
But you could turn it into the Spirit Awards, which we've all been to, and we know they breeze through it in 2 hours.
Right,
they have there's a few more categories of the Oscars, not very many more, but still it's like they make it snappy and it's fun and it moves. Why can't the Oscars do that?
Well, I think that some of it, though, is that there's this hope on, it has to be some of the people in the Academy, but definitely on the part of ABC, that they want the Oscars to be what they used to be 20 years ago, right? There was a time that, and this is, I mean, I don't mean to sound like a million-year-old man, but for a long time, the Oscars were basically the only game in town, right? Like you had the Golden Globes, and then you had the Oscars, and that was the night that you saw all the stars, and that was a big deal. And as we joke about this being this awards slog, but there are so many awards shows leading up to that.
Yeah, it's now the end of the Thousand Mile March.
Right, show. And so really the issue is, through no fault of their own, the Oscars are following all these other shows, and that has to be part of why, not the sole reason, but part of why the ratings have gone down, is because at that point, like, we've seen all these movies get awards, and the novelty of seeing all these stars in one place is not there.
I think that's a really good point. But I don't know that it's just the award shows. It's the novelty of seeing all these stars has gone away because of the world that we live in, and we see them everywhere. But the award shows, obviously being the sixth of six award shows, put you at some disadvantage. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but this was the same argument used by conservatives, oddly, about ESPN, that they've become too liberal, and Jemele Hill and Colin Kaepernick have ruined sports. And they said that ESPN's ratings are declined because of that. But the fact is, ESPN's ratings are not declining any more than anybody else's ratings. Anybody else that requires cable subscribers, ratings have gone down. Right. Television ratings have gone down because people watch things in different ways. The Oscars are a victim of that. As much as anything else, this is a much more global conversation. And that goes to Alonzo's original point that the idea of eliminating makeup and cinematography and editing and documentary short is somehow going to cause a ratings boost. It's crazy. So my hunch is they're not going to change their mind. They'll see that it didn't work this year and they'll restore it next year. And they'll just have a man. One of the great things the Academy has done is they've put you can watch almost any Academy speech now on YouTube of any year that there was television.
That's amazing.
Right? So you want to see John Wayne's True Grit speech? It's there. It used to be harder to find. Somebody had to shoot it off their TV, old. Now it's all there. And those speeches were short, and you didn't have to thank your agent.
Or all your agents.
Right, or all
your team.
All your team. You could just say, maybe my team. And I think that sort of there just needs to be an understanding that, hey, man, you're up there, and you have 90 seconds at the most. And, 60 seconds if you're in a below-the-line category, and 90 seconds if you're above the line, and that's it.
At LA Film Critics, we have a 90-second rule. for us to introduce the winners. The winners can talk all they want.
Honestly, I think what they should do is they should do like the Globes and make it a dinner party with booze. Like that's going to make the Oscars interesting because people are going to be so much.
But nobody relaxes at the Oscars. The Golden Globes, they intrinsically don't care, so it's easier to just kick back and like I'm having this fun evening and drinking champagne with my coworkers. But the Oscars, everybody in that room is on edge.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so the Oscars are next weekend. They're February 24th, and next week on the show we will do some Oscar predictions, and perhaps by then there will be a change.
Completely reversed everything.
So, yeah. We'll have a conversation about that. But either way, we're talking about the Oscars next week, and they are a week from this Sunday. So
I'm going to, because I saw it last night, I told Matt, I'll stamp this conversation by saying I didn't see every movie this year, so I didn't see nearly as many movies as you guys did. But I watched with my wife last night the movie that I already thought was the best movie of 2018, and I now believe it in every part of my bones, and it's not even nominated. But we saw Eighth Grade again.
So
I saw it again. She hadn't seen it. And it's just perfect. It's perfect in every way.
It is. It should have been up there for screenplay. Elsie Fisher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just, nobody gave a better performance than her she was perfect. You can't be better than perfect.
Well, it's a multiple Spirit Award nominee, so those are our real Oscars. There you go. So it's time to move into film reviews now. Christy, Alonzo, Ben, Matt, we are all here. It's magical. Three of us have seen Alita: Battle Angel. Matt, tell us about it.
Alita: Battle Angel is the story of a cyborg named Alita who seems to, her core is her body and kind of her heart, and she gets a new mechanical body from a mysterious doctor, and she doesn't remember where she comes from, and turns out, she's really amazing at fighting, and
battle angel.
Yes, she's angelic, and she battles, and there is...
It's the 27th century?
The 27th century dystopia. This is based on the manga and also anime, Battle Angel Alita. This has been in development by James Cameron for a long, long time. He was talking about this around the time Avatar was in production. You get lots of cyborg on cyborg action. And
that's your main takeaway from this, is that they have cyborg sex?
I meant battling.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's actual action.
There's kissing too. There is kissing. Yeah.
This is not the Bjork video "All Is Full of Love."
So Robert Rodriguez directed this. This is like far and away the largest budget that he has ever even been in the same room with in his lifetime.
I mean, talk about two diametrically opposed filmmakers in terms of means, you know, Cameron and Rodriguez.
So, and in that regard, now that he's got, you know, a more expensive toy box to play in, the action sequences are a lot of fun, and they move really, really well, and they are the only reason to see this film. There is so much going on here. It is so crammed with story, and yet it also simultaneously feels empty in terms of character development. Shocking from a James Cameron film, which he co-wrote and produced. Rosa Salazar, as game as she is for everything, for all the physical demands of this performance capture performance she's giving, there are so many contradictory elements to her character, which I guess will be fleshed out in the many other Alita movies that they think they're going to make someday.
Well,
I don't know.
The predictions are that it's going to really underperform this week. Are that it's actually going to be kind of a bomb.
What did it cost to make? Do we know? I'm going to look it up.
A lot.
11 gajillion.
Yeah, exactly. $1 million. A billion dollars. And so if it doesn't do well, we won't see anymore. Coupled with, this is one of the final films coming out of Fox before Fox is now run by Disney. Yeah. And so who knows if Disney's going to continue this.
According to The Hollywood Reporter, $200 million, and that's probably just the production budget, because there's also an insane amount of marketing everywhere you go. So
there's so much world building going on in this movie, and you're right, it's at the expense of character, and so it's sort of like, it's that thing of, well, the next four movies will really explain what's going on here and why it matters, and in the meantime, you're just sort of left with this very shiny, effects heavy thing. And yeah, there are some fun action sequences, but I didn't care about anything. It felt weirdly reminiscent of Astro Boy, of all things.
And also Rollerball.
definitely some rollerball in there. Yeah, I mean, it's motorball, I think is what they call it here.
It's
and
totally different, you guys. It's not rollerball, it's motorball.
But once that starts, all I thought was, oh God, pod racing. Like, that's what it feels like in this movie. It's like, oh, we're going to pod race now for a while.
And the sport isn't even that exciting. It's not like it's a thrilling, engaging sport that you're in the middle of and you want to be a part of it.
Yeah,
it's like, they
and
skate with a ball.
I didn't care about anything. And it's one of those things where your eyes realize that nothing you're looking at exists in a tangible form. Yeah. And sometimes in a live action movie where it's that CG heavy, it just all becomes like ones and zeros to me. Like nothing has weight, nothing has any kind of real substance or meaning. And so I'm just watching these flickering images of things, but none of it registers as mattering or existing.
Right, and then you have really serious actors like Mahershala Ali and Christoph Waltz and Jennifer Connelly, and you know they are just sort of fighting their way through the ones and zeros and having difficulty registering. I mean, you know, Mahershala Ali can do everything, but the villain he's assigned to play here is just so one note.
Somebody suggested he was doing Matrix cosplay.
It is. Yeah, he's got everything but the leather duster going on. Ed Skrein, who I thought was Nicholas Holt the whole time, he's just a face, essentially. Also, I want to tell you, if you're thinking about taking kids, and I did not take mine, and I'm really glad in retrospect that I didn't, it's extremely violent. And yeah, it is like cyborg violence, and it is like, you know, half human. And half machines getting sliced in half and dismembered, and body parts are flying everywhere.
Right, but it's not blood; it's blue stuff.
It's like Freon.
And also, if you're the kind of person that regularly checks doesthedogdie.com, this might have some triggering moments for you.
Oh yeah, this was the movie I was talking about. Remember last week where I was like, "Doesn't a dog die?" This was the movie I was thinking of. Anyway,
so. When I saw it, I was like, "That's what."
Yes. Mm. So
I'm out.
No, seriously, it's game changing. Yeah. I don't blame you. Speaking of dogs, we have Sabrina here today. She's sitting at my feet, very snuggy on the rug beneath my feet. So it's a jumble. Although I really like Rosa Salazar. I like the choice of Rosa Salazar for this role, and she is giving it her all, and I'm sure it was very challenging physically to do the kind of performance capture, but and there are some moments of excitement like in her self-discovery, but we've seen that. We've seen the character who like doesn't realize she has powers and discovers them.
Is this a John Carter thing where this manga has been around for a while and other people have been borrowing from it, and now that we're going to the source material, it feels tired? Like Valerian, too?
I think so. I think the manga's from – I don't know the dates off the top of my head, but it's been around something for a while, and so there probably is some of that.
Have you read it? Have you seen it?
I haven't.
Because I understand that it's also super violent, and folks who are fans of it are, like, shocked that it could be made in PG-13 form. Mm.
Yeah, I haven't watched it. I just know that it was a manga and then an anime adaptation, and there's at least, like, three or four movies of the adaptation, and there's some books, or maybe there. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway,
can we talk about the eyes?
Well, so I actually thought this movie was okay. Like, it kind of delivered exactly what I expected. Like, okay, this is going to be really over the top. Like, it's not as tight and not as engaging, but it felt a little bit like Pacific Rim. Like, okay, it's not taking itself seriously. It's just going to be kind of bonkers. And it kind of gave me what I really expected. Now, one of the issues that kind of took me out of the movie is that Alita, her whole face is CGI. They've definitely stylized and made her look consistent with – there's another – you end up seeing another character from Mars and looks consistent to her. And then there's the character that the big thug one that
Jackie Earle Haley
that you can't see his face. But then everybody else – like all the other cyborgs, like they're all like those people's faces. They're not redone CGI. So it's this weird inconsistency that
they give her these big eyes, which in an anime is like fine, whatever. But I couldn't stop seeing them. Like I would kind of get into the movie for a while, and then I'd be like, oh yeah, those eyes.
it was a really weird choice. And I get what they're trying to do, which is that because when you start getting flashbacks of her and the other, you know, somebody else from Mars.
Is it Mars or is it the floating
city? The floating city.
It's Mars.
Okay.
Which now people get mad that I spoiled it, but whatever.
Sorry.
So that's consistent because, you know, like, oh, okay, so maybe evolution has happened differently on Mars and whatever. But it's just still a weird choice and kind of unnecessary. But that being said, like, I thought it was fine. I didn't hate this. I had a good time. But again, my expectations were really low here. And no, this one was not one that I'd had a bunch to drink before.
Let's be clear.
I did.
I got a
did
little,
you? What did you drink? What did you have?
I think I had a margarita.
Okay.
I got a little, I was a little bored from time to time. And, you know, like it doesn't have the sort of reckless pulpiness of something like Planet Terror, you know, where Rodriguez is just like going full genre and like going for nothing but sensation. This one, it feels like he's really trying to sort of craft, because you get thrown a ton of exposition. It's like, it's in the future and there's been a horrible thing and there's a floating city and then they live on the earth and it's a dystopia, but it's a nice dystopia where everybody has oranges and chocolate. So how bad can it be? I don't know. By the end of it, I was just kind of like, can we just, I don't care.
I just found it exhausting and like not in a fun way.
I don't know. I think I had more of a good time at this. I thought it moved well. It was, you know, I mean, again, like, this is a better movie about robots fighting than, say, most of the Transformers movies are.
Except for Bumblebee.
If that's the bar.
But that is the bar, right? I mean, those are the ones that keep getting shoved down our throats. So
but
I would
these
actually,
are also, like, human-sized robots.
Yeah, but look, like, I would see another one of these. Like, I was kind of into it, and I thought it was okay.
Well, in theory, you're going to get many more. We'll see if that actually happens. I'd be curious to see if that actually happens.
We'll see what the new bosses at the mouse say.
Right, so I'm saying 5.6.
I give it a 6.3, which I'm feeling is a little generous, but you know, it is an achievement of something. Like, there's so much stuff up there, you know, like the technologically, like there's a lot going on. So I'm giving him points for that, but I was not into it.
I think I may have talked myself up into a slightly higher score, but I'll stick with my 6.5.
Okay,
but so I think this is worth seeing.
Our number's a 6.1.
I, as a mere observer or listener, really, I wasn't watching. There's no way you give it a 6.5 and you gave it a 6.3.
Okay, fine. I'll give it a 6 and you give it a 6.8, and it's the same number.
Okay, sure.
All right, fair enough.
Are you sure?
Yes. Okay. I give it a 6.8.
Okay.
So
all
we're
right.
6.1.
Well, 6.1, 61% on the tomato meter. It's in that like 59, 61 kind of up and down on the fresh line there. Yeah. So, yeah, if indeed there are more Alitas to be had, we'll talk about them. Mm. We're talking about Happy Death Day to You, a sequel which has come out just like a year and a half after the original Happy Death Day.
Well, yeah.
That's how good it was.
It's Blumhouse. They make things
They
happen.
Pump them out. Mm-hmm. Alonzo, please tell us about the sequel.
Sure. So director Christopher Landon is back. This time he's writing. And this time the movie kind of takes a detour from comedy slasher to comedy slasher sci-fi. We begin on the morning of the following day. And this time, instead of following Tree, we're following
Ryan,
who is Tree's boyfriend's roommate. And Ryan, as it turns out, has been working on an experiment of the Sisyphus device known as Sissy.
Involving quantum mechanics.
Involving quantum mechanics and time, blah, 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 science.
Right. Memo to everybody. If you're in a movie and you realize you're in a movie, abandon all of your work in quantum science because it's just going to cause problems.
Exactly. So Ryan finds himself being stalked by a killer in a baby mask, but then before we realize it, Tree understands that he has opened up a time loop, and when they refire the machine, Tree is living the same day over and over again, just like in the first movie. Ooh. But in a parallel dimension where her boyfriend is no longer her boyfriend, but her mom is still alive. Will she stay? Will she go? Can she learn all the algorithms so that she can teach these guys how to fix the time machine when the day keeps repeating over and over again and they don't remember anything? You'll have to watch and find out.
This movie is so much fun, and it is as fun as the original with the added benefit of having some actual emotional heft.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was shocked.
The debate she has within herself as far as whether to stay and be with her mom, who she loves, who died recently, or be with the guy she thinks is the one. I mean, it's serious. It's like borderline tear jerky. It's well done to manage that balance in a horror comedy where it already was pulling off a tricky balance.
I was amazed that they made those emotions actually kind of land and mean something.
Yeah, Jessica Roth is so game for everything. Her timing is amazing. There's a couple sequences where she's like reliving all the same stuff and she's so angry. She's just going to explode.
So irritated.
And it's hilarious. And like her timing is so great. She does the big stuff well, like the big physical fighting stuff, but also like really tiny, like, side eye and just reactions to things. And her comic timing is super. So this, I mean, between the first one and this one, like, she should be a major star that the world knows about. She's so great.
Yeah, I like this a lot. It starts out, you know, starts out doing something that you think is a little different. It's like, oh, okay, maybe we're following someone else. And then it actually tilts into something that I started to get really worried about, because when they start explaining the time loop, I was like, oh, no.
That's kind of a joke, though, don't you think?
Well, yes.
But no, I know what you mean. Excessive exposition. Right. Like, oh, don't tell me.
Right. Like, when you first get the reason, you know, when you realize, oh.
Why the first movie happened.
Right. Like, you start to get like, oh, no. Are they going to, like, over-explain all of this? And I was really, really concerned. I was like, because I was like, oh, crap, this is going to go sideways. And then they make it work, and I was really impressed. Now, there's a little bit that, having remembered, you know, when she starts going through the deaths again, I'm like, wasn't there an issue in the first one? And but that's okay. I thought this is a lot of fun. It's, you're right. She's super game, and this did have a kind of shocking level of emotion, not just with the mom, but with her roommate. Mm-hmm. Right, like
Ruby Bodine,
yeah, the
daughter of Matthew,
right? Which in the first right, her roommate in the first one ends up being someone who's the killer, right? Like, and if you're calling spoiler alert on the first one, like
a year and a half ago, come on,
windows closed. But this one, like, oh, she is saying goodbye to that person too. Like, it's, yeah, I was really impressed with this. I like this movie a lot, and I think it's worth seeing.
It reminded me periodically of Real Genius, and for me, that is very high praise.
It reminded me so much of Real Genius with, like, all the nerdy friends in the science lab and how they're the real heroes. And, yes, I love Real Genius, too, so I definitely made that connection in my mind as well.
And even the stuff that, like, is so just played for such comedy, like the scene with the sorority president getting the keys.
Rachel Matthews.
Right. Rachel Matthews getting the keys. Like, it's so slapsticky and so dopey, and it's almost like it got dropped in from another movie. But you know what? It's fine. Because it works. It lands. It's funny. And it's like, you know, they go, there's a lot of times that this movie goes right to the edge of like, oh, this is going to be too much and it's going to lose me. And then it just comes right back. And I'm impressed with
that. Right. And the whole sorority president character has been done so many times, and she's always vapid and she's always bitchy. And she is that here too, but there's more going on with her. She gets a chance to play with that character in ways.
Because it's the alternate dimension version.
Right. And it's a good example of how this movie kind of upend your expectations of what this movie ordinarily is like. I also very much like Israel Broussard as the guy who is her boyfriend in one dimension from the first film, but then not. And Fee Vu is Ryan, the main scientist, the roommate who makes all this happen. I like him a lot. He, in other kinds of movies from the 80s, would have been a certain kind of really uncomfortable stereotype and is not. And I appreciate that about that in this film.
Yeah, all the actual scientists are people of color from various parts of the world, and none of them are like sort of the two-dimensional pocket protector type, you know, geek. You know, they're all funny and individual and interesting in their own way.
Yeah, this is very fun, and it moves really, really well, and it's full of surprises. So yes, go see it. I do, though, think that you need to have seen Happy Death Day to see this. I mean, like, they do explain in the first couple of minutes, where, you know, when we first see Tree again, she explains what happened in Happy Death Day, but it's so much more fun if you have actually seen Happy Death Day.
And there are jokes you'll catch later, only if you saw the first movie.
Yes.
And you should, because it's a fun movie.
So, I think this movie balances horror and comedy, or at least the scariness and comedy, the way we saw in Cabin in the Woods. And it's almost in a different vibe, but it's the way some of Sam Raimi's stuff can really balance that. I think that this is awesome.
Bibb said something in his review for The Wrap that I really liked, which is a lot of times with sequels, people have to unlearn the lessons they learned in the first movie to then learn them all over again. And Tree actually gets to learn a different lesson in this movie, and it's based on the person that she wound up being after the first movie was over. So this is a movie where they don't just retread it. They actually take that character and where we left her as opposed to where we met her, and then goes into a further place with that. And that's a subtle needle to thread that a lot of sequels don't bother to do.
Yes. Sounds more like a effective second episode of a good television series.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, and it's not exactly scary, I wouldn't say, but it is tense. There are moments of legitimate tension. Like, and part of it is like the baby mask is so ridiculous. Like, it's so silly and yet so creepy at the same time. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'm giving it an 8.
I said 8.2.
What did I give it?
8.5. Okay. So our number is an 8.2. It is at only 66%.
What? Oh, come on.
That's way too low. It's a lot of fun. So don't listen to all those other people. Listen to us.
Yes, always.
And yeah, so go see Happy Death Day to you. So it was Valentine's Day.
This week.
Yesterday-ish.
Ish.
How was everyone's Valentine's Day, by the way? What did you guys do?
We don't make a big thing of it. We exchange cards, and that's about it. Because it's like... Valentine's Day is to love what St. Patrick's Day is to drinking. It's sort of amateur night, you know.
Wait, you don't drink on Valentine's Day?
I did a Q&A at a screening and took my wife and daughter.
What movie was it?
RBG. Super,
oh, cool.
Super romantic.
It is.
I'm sure your toddler really dug it.
So apparently, like, she was great because she behaved. And I made eye contact with her a couple times during the screening and a huge smile on her face. And I get home and I was like, she was great. You know, she was up till like 9:30, 9:45, way later, way past her bedtime. And she didn't have school today. And then Lee goes, yeah, no, it was great. She goes, we were less than 2 minutes in when she looked up and without any whispering said from the back row, Mama, this is really boring. Can we leave now? Wait.
Someday she won't think
that. Take my phone. Play a game.
Yes. I took Nick and Chris to a movie last night, too.
I took them
to the documentary Apollo 11, which is incredible, which I've sent you guys all screening info on.
Yes,
this is this never-before-seen footage of the moon mission. It's incredible.
It premiered at Sundance.
Yes.
I made dinner last night, and then Jen decided she wanted to read, so I pretty much just played Forza Horizon 4 all night.
There you go. That's
which was
love.
Awesome.
So two
we
of
did
us...
what, we did watch Sorry Angel, actually. We watched a French film.
That's romantic.
Right, and then we watched, as I mentioned, we watched 8th Grade afterwards. Mm-hmm. But two of us took our small children and spouses to documentaries.
That's called love.
Happy Valentine's
Day,
everybody.
But none of us bonked our heads, hopefully, as Rebel Wilson does in Isn't It Romantic. For those of you keeping score at home, this is 2 weeks in a row where women bonk their heads in a movie and it gives them like superpowers or transports them to an alternate parallel universe.
Oh, What Men Want.
Yes.
That was
yes. And of course, what was it? The Amy Schumer one, a couple years ago, last year. So Rebel Wilson is a young woman working in an architecture firm where she's totally put upon. She lives in this really cramped and shabby apartment in New York City. And she hates romantic comedies, and she has from a very young age. And she and her friends discuss how awful they are. I mean, they all think they're great, and they name check like Pretty Woman and 13 Going on 30 and Notting Hill.
Sweet Home Alabama.
Right, all these movies that they love, and she hates them. She gets mugged on the subway on the way home from work one day, and she bonks her head. And when she wakes up in the hospital, everything is magically transformed, and there are flowers and cupcakes everywhere, and the hunky doctor is flirting with her, and she goes home. One of my favorite bits in this movie is that she has this impossibly spacious apartment with this giant closet with every possible color of shoe, and they're all in her size, and her,
it's suddenly a Nancy Myers architecture.
Yeah, and her dog, her little fluffy multi poo, whatever it is, which had been all drab and shabby, like has a beautiful blowout at the groomers.
Right.
Like
there's does all the tricks,
right? And so she's been transported to a romantic comedy, and she's got to learn life lessons to figure out how to get out of it. It is as high concept. A high concept comedy as you can get. Like, you don't even need a whole elevator ride to give the elevator pitch. You can like press the button in the time it takes to explain the hook of this film. And that's funny here and there.
Sure.
That's funny here and there. I smile the whole way through. Rebel Wilson is incredibly game physically for anything. She's got this incredible timing, this sly deadpan way with a throwaway one-liner here and there, and it's funny, but then it's trying to have its cake and eat it too. It's trying to make fun of romantic comedies while then also being a very traditional kind of romantic comedy. And when you realize that that's all that is there underneath it, it's like, huh.
Yeah, it does definitely, you know, it loves the thing that it mocks a little too much. And so which I think cuts into the mockery and cuts into the sort of point of the film. Also, this movie feels like 5 or 10 years too late. I mean, when Crazy Rich Asians came out last year, it was like, oh, yes, the romantic comedy. Where have they been? You know, but there was a moment there, which the movie references, where they were just coming out, like that post-Pretty Woman era that went well into the aughts, you know, where we had tons of them. And I think they would have been riper for satire then. As it is now, it's sort of like, oh, yeah, rom-coms, it's... Yeah, that was a thing for a while.
Yeah, the ones with, like, Katherine Heigl and Kate Hudson and, like, the pre-McConnaissance Matthew McConaughey.
Exactly. Like, where did they all go, you know? But so that just felt a little weird. Like, the movie pretends like they're super of the moment, and it's like, no, they're, you know, they're being rerun on Ion or something.
Right, and, like, you know, we do have good ones like To All the Boys I've Loved Before. I mean, it's possible to make a good, smart, romantic comedy that is, you know, not cheesy, that still hits all those beats that you want to be satisfied by the end. Yeah, I wish I had more bite to it.
But I did laugh. I mean, I did have fun.
I did too.
And I like the look of it, but it's a little soft.
Yeah, I mostly like this. It's mercifully short. Which it could have gone on much longer.
It's like 85 minutes.
Right, so they realize...
Tell me more.
Yeah. All of a sudden, Ben's ears perk up.
Right, so they realize that they need to be out relatively quickly. I felt like there's places where they could have gone farther with the jokes because I think they leave some material on the table in that she realizes she's in a rom-com and doesn't quite... Like, she's more irritated by it than anything else. Like, there's that karaoke scene where suddenly, like, it becomes a dance number and... You kind of wish someone like that would be like, oh, what can I get away with here?
Sure. Right? How do I exploit this?
Yeah. Right. How do you exploit that? And there's elements of that, but not far enough. I think, you know, everybody in here is pretty fun. So not only is she fun, I think Hemsworth is like Hemsworth when she wakes up in the dream becomes Australian, but like really over the top, like super goofy Australian. And he's funny in this.
It's Liam, we should say,
right,
not
Liam,
Chris.
Right. Liam Hemsworth.
Name that Hemsworth.
And he's got those, you know, he's got this really heavy, like over the top, almost Crocodile Dundee accent. Like he's really overdoing it.
Betty Gilpin, I thought was hilarious.
Yeah. Betty Gilpin was good. Priyanka Chopra, I thought was funny in this as kind of the rival for, what's his name?
Adam Devine. Yes, frequent Rebel Wilson co-star Adam Devine.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, my complaint with this movie is I kind of wish it went farther with what it was doing, because it doesn't. But that being said, it, you know, it's fine. It's,
oh, right. There are a couple in the Pitch Perfect movies.
The first two Pitch Perfect movies.
I totally forgot about that.
Yes, right, yes. They have a chemistry. But this reminded me, as I was watching it, of Ready Player One. In that, it's a lot of...
For girls!
There's a thing, and there's a thing, and there's a thing you know, and there's an obscure thing you know, and oh, she's really wearing the exact dress and hat that Julia Roberts wore in Pretty Woman. Like, it's a whole lot of, like, here's a bunch of recognition that's going to make you smile and feel like you're in on the joke.
There are a few subtle gags, and I wish there were more of them.
Like every time she throws something out the window.
Yeah, that, right? For instance.
Every time she throws something out of the window, because it's this perfect romantic comedy world... Somebody thanks her,
yes.
Right? Like, oh, thanks. I've been looking for this.
The fact that, like, everywhere she goes, everybody's at a couple, like, even all the right. background are couples. Yeah. When she is in Central Park and she walks to where the Bethesda fountain is, that sort of
right.
portico you have to walk under is, like, clean and shiny and, like, stained yeah. glass. The fact that every store on the street is, like, flowers or cupcakes.
That part is funny. You know, I laughed at the right. bit over and over again where she tries to curse.
Yes.
Oh, and she yeah. can't.
Because
like,
it's a PG-13 romantic comedy.
Right. See, there's some stuff like that. Like, she can't curse. She can't actually have sex. Like, that whole bit was funny. And I kind of wish there would have been more of that and playing with those rules. And it kind of abandons that, which was a little bit of a bummer.
And it's more fun as a movie about movies than it is about you giving a crap about her character and her growth.
Right. And also, like, she's clearly going to end up with Adam Devine. Spoiler.
Yeah. I mean, Liam Hemsworth, you know, is clearly the Mr. Wrong.
It is still, like, it's still a formulaic romantic comedy. It doesn't really deviate very much from that formula.
Right.
And so it's not like it's really as subversive as it thinks it is.
Yeah. I mean, somebody was saying that if you're going to parody a genre, A, you have to sort of, like, have some inherent... well, I guess it's love for the genre is not the problem here. But you still have to be telling a story in that. Like, Airplane, for all of the craziness and all of the curlicues on it, is ultimately there is a plot you can follow about a guy who has to land a plane. Yeah. And this one, there's less of, okay, is she going to make her big presentation about parking garages?
I feel like this is trying to do what Edgar Wright did with his Cornetto trilogy, in that it's trying to, like, lovingly send up a genre and then increasingly become a legitimate example of that genre. But that is such a tricky line to walk, and they just don't. Yeah. Do you remember that movie with Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler from a few years back?
They Came Together.
They Came Together. I mean, that was just like a straight-up spoof.
Yeah.
And this isn't that quite fun.
I didn't like that one either, but this doesn't work in a different way. But if you held a gun to my head to watch another one again, I would pick this one.
Yes. So which number? I'm saying 6. I smiled the whole way through, but there's just like not a lot there.
6.8. I was mostly charmed, but I did. I just wanted to go a little bit further.
Yeah. It's not quite what it should be, but it gets points for being short. So 7.
Okay. So 6.6 is our number. It's a 67% on the tomato meter.
Right on it.
There we go. We are the Vox Populi.
So Fighting With My Family is up next, and it is based on the true story of WWE diva Paige. Matt, will you tell us about this?
So Stephen Merchant directed this movie. It's based on the documentary The Wrestlers Fighting With My Family, which is the story of Paige, a.k.a. Soraya Beavis, and her rise to – or her – kind of training and then rise to fame in the WWE. She comes from a wrestling family. She and her brother Zach had been sending tapes to the WWE, and they end up WWE scouts and the production end up out in London, and they go for a tryout, and only Paige is accepted, and that causes tension with her and her brother. And then she's got to go through training in Florida, and it's brutal, and she doesn't think she can do it, but she wants to get her shot. And The Rock makes an appearance.
As himself.
He makes many appearances. And he's a producer.
And I really like this movie. I was really surprised at how much I really like this, and I'm not sure why. I think it's easy to write off professional wrestling for a variety of reasons, and rightly or wrongly, without really paying attention to the fact that it is still so popular and so many people watch it. And this movie works really well. I think the actress that plays Paige, Florence Pugh,
is amazing.
Lady Macbeth
is really, really, really good in this. And actually, so is Vince Vaughn. Vince Vaughn as the trainer, a scout trainer, who is playing, you know, he's not really playing anything for laughs here. Like, he's this harsh coach that he's really working these wrestlers hard. And I think he's great in this.
He's dialing down the Vince Vaughnishness of it all.
Yeah, he's not doing his, you know, like typical comfortable Vince Vaughn shtick. Like he's being harsh, and yet like not in a way that's like overt or a caricature. Like he's acting, and I don't mean that in a really obnoxious way. No. Like he's putting in a good performance here, and it's like, oh right, Vince Vaughn can act, and it's great to see him act in this. And I, you know, this movie balances being funny and moving, and I felt kind of engaged with the tension that was going on in the family. And I felt like the, you know, some of the scenes that are going on, like I would be on the edge of my seat watching the fight scenes. Mm-hmm. And even though you know what's happening, and it gives you a little bit about what the world of wrestling is like, I thought this was a really fun movie. And I, again, was surprised by how much I liked it. But this was a good time.
It's a lovely sports movie. I really kind of I got into it. I don't follow the WWE.
Wrestling's not a sport. Continue.
I had never heard of Paige before. Well, they make a distinction early on in the film that wrestling isn't fake, but it's scripted.
Right, it's fixed.
So it's fixed, and they know it's going to happen, but it's still physically hard to do. So it is a sport in that respect.
And they're athletes. Like, they're in shape. They're in ridiculous shape.
Fine. Okay, then it's like ballet.
You just don't like it because you can't bet on it.
However, that did kind of throw me in the big finale, which is like her premiere appearance in the WWE. They sort of build it up like it's the big fight at the end of a boxing movie, but it's kind of like, wait, isn't this written? Like, didn't y'all decide beforehand who was going to win? Like, that part, I didn't quite get what we were supposed to be thinking about. Like, we were just thinking this was a thing that could go either way, or that I think is that one tiny thing where it fell apart. As far as I thought the family relationship is really interesting. The parents are played by Nick Frost and Lena Headey, and the brother is played by this British actor. I looked him up, and he's been in everything.
Jack Loudon.
Yeah. Yes, Jack Loudon. He's in Mary Queen of Scots. He's in 71. Anyway,
Frost and Headey are hilarious in this.
Yeah, so like the four of them are great, and you believe them as a family. And I loved what the movie had to say about like what the outer edges of this world looks like and what it looks like to run a wrestling gym in Norwich, England, you know, and the whole idea of it, it's, you know, there's something about WWE that is so singularly American in its sort of like big brash vulgarity. Mm-hmm. And so watching these British people being so into it and trying to emulate it, it's like watching like a Japanese rockabilly band, yeah, you know, where it's like they get the essence of it, but you just, you're not used to seeing it come out of those mouths, you know?
Well,
so that, yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah. One of the things I liked about this movie is that this movie really captures how there's an element, and you see this in the movie, like this movie has a, hits a lot of notes that you would see in a boxing movie, right? Where, yeah, it's the training, and you realize somebody can come from nowhere in a way that you don't necessarily see in other professional sports, but somebody can come off of, you know, Rocky does this, right? Like he's this no one, this workaday boxer that, oh, wait, he's got a shot at the title. And that happens with her to a certain extent, but yet there's also this side of like showmanship that they keep hitting on.
Yes.
And is, drink, germane to the plot in that, you know, one of the things, among other things, one of the things that Paige has to overcome is her willingness to really, like, her stage fright. Like, she's got to get past, like, she's got to be able to work the crowd and really be there. And she doesn't, she's got to abandon her, like, yes, she understands what wrestling, you know, like, you learn about receipts, for instance, which is something that I never knew about, right? Like, she hits somebody, and it's, well, you do a receipt because if they miss a mark, that's how you teach them, and she gets blowback for that. And so she,
of the group of people that she's training with, of the women, she's the only one who actually has a wrestling background. The other ones, right, are like models or cheerleaders or whatever, who are like, they're athletic and they're strong, but they don't know the moves and stuff. And her immediate reaction is to sort of be offended by that. And one of the things I think the movie does so well is that those other women were sort of, we're trained by years of movies to think, oh, well, they're going to be mean girls and they're going to shut her out. But it's actually, no, as it turns out, she's shutting them out and she shouldn't.
Right.
Yeah, they're, that relationship with the other girls, the more traditionally pretty, like all-American blondes, is one of many, many examples here of how this movie upends your expectations of a sports movie. Because it looks like pure formula. And it has the elements of pure,
right,
formula.
The training,
like, training montage.
Yeah.
Right. And again, like she comes from nothing. And she's, right, scrappy, and she, but, right, she's got heart.
And to call the family, and I can't do this.
Yeah.
And, right, I
mean, she works like, her can, way up.
You could map, yeah, Rudy to this.
Yeah, and right, and then, you know, and Vince Vaughn is there to like push her and be the tough coach and be, right, demanding of her.
Yeah.
And it's got all of the kinds of characters and the kinds of elements that you expect. But yeah, the thing with the other girls or the other women rather is one of many examples of how it keeps surprising you. And there's like a scruffiness to this movie that I really like. It is the opposite of a glossy feel-good sports movie, and yet you feel really good walking out of it. Florence Pugh is a major star. I don't know if you guys saw Lady Macbeth. She's so incredible. Have you seen that?
I need to.
Oh, my God, you guys. She's the complete opposite, yeah, of this character. She is, she in that she's quietly powerful and just like devastatingly so, and she takes power, and it's chilling to watch. She's not, you know, a feel-good character at all. And to see that she's got a really complicated indie drama in her and what is very traditionally a big feel-good kind of sports movie, she's got it all in her. And so maybe people will, right, now know who Florence Pugh is.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because this is an interesting role in which that she plays a character who has, she's, you know, to Ben, one of the things I think about when Ben talks about people who are good at their job doing their job well. Mm-hmm. And she's really, like, she knows wrestling. She's really good at it. But she knows her version of that. And what the WWE does is a little bit different. And she's got to leave some of that. And that matches up with her lack of confidence. Like, that aggravates her lack of confidence in other places. And I found that really fascinating. I thought, you're right, she's got a great performance. And the movie, you know, it keeps moving along in such a way that, you know, it hits all the notes. And look, like, you know, Paige ends up being a star. And, yeah, but I like this movie a lot.
And for a movie that's produced by the WWE, clearly intending to sell the WWE and to sell Paige as this, you know, product.
It worked.
It does. But I think the movie also is very honest about, like, I think through the Vaughn character, how hard it is, how the kind of career you can have if you're not a star, and, right, what that can do to your psyche, yep, and your body and all that stuff.
We get a few examples of that, right? Like, there's the older brother.
Yeah.
There's, you know, the story Vaughn tells. So
it's not all like roses and champagne.
It can chew you up and spit you back out again. What was I going to say? I totally forgot. Oh, I knew nothing at all about wrestling, by the way. Or I had never even heard of Paige walking into this.
I did not either.
But I tweeted at Dave Schilling, who, you know Dave Schilling, Ben. Longtime sports writer, culture writer, and he's a massive wrestling expert.
Really, really smart guy.
He is, and he tweets about wrestling a lot. So I tweeted him yesterday. I said, you've got to tell me what you think about this movie because your opinion is the only one I trust on this. And he said it was really good. Like, it took like tiny tweaks of the Paige story and change them slightly, but pretty much was very true to it. During the credits, you will see
clips from the documentary.
Actual footage, which they recreate like word for word with like the same hair colors and the same camera angles and the same clothes. And so there's an attention to detail to getting that life right. But he said it for him, it was like top five wrestling movie.
Interesting. There's this is somewhat of a secondary consideration, but there's a real interesting chemistry between Lena Headey and Nick Frost.
Is that how you say her name? It's not Lena Headey? I don't know. I think
it might be Headey.
I was reading it wrong my whole life then. Sorry,
I'm
Lena.
I'm not sure.
It's Headley.
I don't know. But yeah, but they're fun. They're fun together too, yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see some kind of movie with them as a couple, as a whole set. I mean, not necessarily those characters, but they had a really interesting chemistry that I thought was fun.
Right. It's fun to see her like badass with the tats and the lip ring and the pink hair and like the metal shirts. And it's a very different role for her. But yeah, they have a really fun chemistry with each other, those two.
And if you are a fan of, hang on, before we start getting her name right, British comedy great Julia Davis, she has a brief appearance in a couple of scenes as Merchant's wife.
Oh, right. Yes, Stephen Merchant is in this, too. It's pretty funny.
The scene with the potential in-laws.
Headey.
Thank you.
Yeah. What is Headey?
The potential Merchant and Davis is the brother's girlfriend's parents.
Right.
Are very fun.
Yeah. Anyway, so we all liked it. My number is a 7.9.
I also said 7.9.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to change my number.
No!
7.9.
Okay, thank you. That makes sense. I was a little worried there. 7.9 is our number. It is at 91% on the tomato meter. So I think it might be just limited this weekend, but when it reaches your part of the world, please go check it out.
Yeah.
We're playing a little bit of catch up here, and I'm so glad we are because this movie is so great. It's High Flying Bird. It's on Netflix. It came out just like last week, and it's out there for you to watch, and you should. Ben, please tell us about it.
Yeah,
High Flying Bird is a sports movie with no sports.
Minimal sports. There's a little sports.
They dribble a basketball like one time.
Barely, yeah. I mean, really, like Andre Holland takes a couple of four-foot jumpers while talking to Bill Duke.
There's a one-on-one that we don't see.
That's right. There's a one-on-one that we don't see.
A couple seconds.
So Andre Holland plays Ray Burke. He's an agent. The movie basically is like 3 days in his life. And he's got a big client. His client was the first player taken in the NBA draft. But that client, Eric Scott, can't make any money because the NBA is in a lockout. And the movie sort of details over 72 hours Ray Burke's attempt to end the lockout. And all of that is really unimportant to us because what is important is sort of watching the machinations of, again, the game above the game that exists that enables the game to go on, and watching Burke maneuver with Sonia Sohn, who plays the
so good.
She's just as good an actress as there is, and she plays the president of the Players Association, working fighting the owners to try to end the lockout. And the story with a couple other characters involved sort of, again, is over 3 days. That process as it plays out as Eric Scott's relationship with Ray Burke gets there incredibly close, and then it gets strained and everything gets sort of pulled apart while Burke works it away. You got to pay super close attention. Or you will miss what he's doing. And even if you're paying attention, you will miss what he's doing.
It's a bit of sleight of hand that goes on there.
It benefits from repeated.
This is a heist movie. This is absolutely a heist movie.
Yeah. And it's a
Soderbergh heist movie. And when you get to the end of it, you realize what the heist is. I think this movie is terrific. Zazie Beetz is great in this as his assistant.
So good.
Bill Duke, this is one of my favorite Bill Duke performances maybe since Predator. He's so awesome in this.
He plays an old-time New York like rec league coach
up in the Bronx.
In the Bronx, yeah,
From the court where this number one draft pick came from.
That's right.
Right, so played by Melvin Gregg is his name.
Right, and you get bits of this backstory to Burke's first client, his cousin, and where that came from. And there's a lot of talk about how the league uses people, and the movie's not subtle about mapping out the way the league treats players not far off of slavery, and it gets played up the way Bill Duke reacts to that.
Well, the movie's kind of like almost a feature-length ad for the book, The Revolt of the Black Athlete.
And we get a little Harry Edwards, who wrote the book.
As a cameo
there at the end of the movie.
So, yeah, this works on so many levels. I mean, first of all, it's the second movie in a row that Steven Soderbergh has shot on an iPhone.
Mm.
Which
right.
I don't know that you necessarily realize that
right.
as you're watching it.
Right. The only way you'd really notice is on some of the, like, when you see, like, the vertical lines sometimes towards the sides of the shot are a little curved in. They're mm-hmm. a little, like, what, anamorphic?
Well, there's kind of like a tilt pan of, right. of Andre Holland.
What was the first one called? Unsane?
Unsane.
So I thought, and I liked Unsane, too. I like this one more. Unsane strikes me as a harder movie to shoot on an iPhone than this one. But there were some moments during Unsane, and again, this was, to be able to pull that off. And again, I'm sure that the technology is better 3 years, 4 years later, whatever it's been since Unsane. But there were a couple of moments in Unsane where I thought, that could be brighter.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And there are some scenes here as well. Like, there's a scene in a bar where Andre Holland and Sonia San are talking, and it is dark, but I feel like those moments, it's intentional.
Yeah, it was a bar. I didn't feel it. In fact, I forgot. I knew he'd shot it with an iPhone, but until you mentioned it, when I was watching it, I forgot.
I didn't know during the watching of the thing, but in retrospect, it's like, oh, of course, because he's done that before, and he likes to play with technology and play with form, and it still feels glossy. And of course, he always shoots his own stuff, and he cuts his own stuff, and it moves so beautifully. It does move with, like, the zippy verve of one of his Ocean's movies, for
sure. I want
to
mention Terrell Alvin McCraney.
He wrote the script.
Who wrote the script, who wrote Moonlight.
Yeah, the dialogue's incredible.
Yeah, this is so sharp. Like, I don't know anything about sports, I think we've established over the years. And, certainly not about, like, the behind the scenes of sports management. But the way this movie brings you into that world and explains what's going on and gets into these larger issues of the white owners versus the black players.
Right. And without being really expository about
exactly. Yeah, and it all feels super organic. And it was interesting because I saw What Men Want and then came home and watched this movie.
They're both about sports agents.
And they're both about sports agents, but they're on different planets. Although they do both have that guy from the Hawks, the
Carl Anthony.
Carl Anthony, yes.
And they're both about sports agents trying to secure the number one draft pick in the NBA.
Yes, yes. There were a lot of moments I was like, what? But yeah, this is a much smarter movie and a much more realistic film about what that world looks like.
And this movie has Donovan Mitchell, Carl Anthony Towns, and Reggie Jackson, three NBA players not drafted at the same time and sort of interwoven, telling their stories of coming into the league. And it's pretty effective as well. I also thought in this movie that there was, like, this is how black people felt in every movie released before 1960 and in many after that also, because all three white characters who have any sort of meaningful role in this are sinister and awful.
Right. Kyle McLaughlin
and Zachary Quinto, mm-hmm. and a little bit, he's got one scene, but we love his work always consistently, Glenn Fleshler, who mm-hmm. plays the sort of I thought an owner, but maybe not. Who tells him?
Oh,
like,
right. He is just one of the owners. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, when he finds out there's a ploy made by Ray Burke to sort of force the end of the lockout. And again, all the guys care about money. They care about people. And they're like, we got to crush this instantly.
One of the many things I love about the script is that there's a really heightened nature to the rat-a-tat of the dialogue. Right? It's otherworldly. Like, we all wish we were that smart in the moment all the time, but there's also such a groundedness to it and such a realism and such a contemporary nature to the story it's trying to tell. And I love how it functions on both of those levels simultaneously. It's really tough to do. It is an allegory about slavery. It is an allegory about capitalism, but it also, if you want to just watch it as a fun sports movie and just watch actors doing their jobs beautifully, you can do that too.
And you mentioned that the way that dialogue is pulled off, and again, it sounds like the kind of movie that could have been written by
David Mamet.
No, yes, but the other one. You Coen do. Brothers. Newsroom.
Oh, a few good men.
Aaron Sorkin.
So, but, you know, and it's... But,
no. Nobody's that didactic.
No. Actually. I'm saying, but it's like, so it's proof that, like, and obviously when Sorkin is at his best, you know, West Wing, A Few Good Men, it's brilliant, right? And I saw To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway, and I think it's really wonderful. But sometimes it's ridiculous, right? Sure. The manner in which they're talking. Molly's Game, there were moments in it where you're like, come on, man. This is not... but you don't have any of that here. Like, no. You can have smart people talking quickly, saying smart things in a way that feels totally genuine, and that's what happens.
Just like us.
Yes, totally. Andre Holland, in case you guys were not aware, is amazing.
Yeah, go back and watch The Nick if you haven't.
I've never seen The Nick, and so now I see what that Soderbergh-Andre Holland connection is like. It's so great. Because one thing I love about this, and I love this about Regina Hall in Support the Girls, too, is like he's figuring out who he has to be in every situation in order to get what he needs from every single situation. They're all transactions, and he's always like on his feet and he's hustling, but he also cares deeply. It's not just about the money. It's not just about the power. He wants to make a difference. And so watching him navigate every bit of this treacherous situation he's in is really fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great cast, extraordinary script, Soderbergh. Totally on his game. I would not be shocked if this is at least going to come up when I sit down at the end of the year to make my best of the year list. It's at least going to be in the conversation.
There is no sports movie ever made that requires you to pay closer attention to what's going on. I mean, you can't, some of the best sport, we talked about good football movies before the Super Bowl, and great, some great ones. North Dallas 40 is a great, smart movie and sort of that vilifies the NFL, but it's still a sports movie. You don't have to, if you miss a line, you'll be okay. Here, man, this is more of a business movie than a sports
movie.
This
is a one screen experience.
Yes. Yes. My number is 9. I loved it.
I said 9 also.
What did I say?
You said 8.5.
8.5.
Yeah. 8.5? I'm too low. I'm going to give it an 8.5 too, which is going to pull us to 8.8.
8.8 is our number. It's at 92% on the tomato meter. You can watch it right now from the comfort of your couch on Netflix once you're done listening to us.
That's right.
It is now time, as it so frequently is, to talk about True Detective. We've only got a few more episodes left. Actually, two more now to watch. But we're going to discuss episode 6 of this third season called Hunters in the Dark. And Alonzo is going to give us a little recap.
Oh, boy. What do we learn this week? Well, okay, first of all, Scoop McNairy, closeted homosexual. That's news. And does that mean that he's not the father of either child? Who knows? But certainly the phone call from Julie in 1990 puts him back in the hot seat and makes them think that he has been a suspect all along. The peephole in the closet has been addressed with the cousin, who swears he didn't put it there.
The cousin's not dead, you guys.
The cousin's not dead.
Didn't we think he might be dead?
Well, I think the cousin's dead in 2015.
Right, he's dead in 2015.
He's definitely dead now.
Yeah, he's at the bottom of the quarry. But in 1990, he's a total scuzzbag, and he's trying to get $7,000 out of the cops to basically tell them about Hoyt, who was apparently paying off the mom, and that's why she OD'd in the motel.
And we learned that because he's dead in 2015, where the presumption, because obviously they did something, and I thought they killed both the cousin and the other cop. But there's a zillion people, given the life the cousin was leading, who could have killed the cousin and put him in a quarry,
including the cops.
Yes. Including the redheaded cop, yeah. Right.
That ending, you guys, that final shot, I gasped audibly. Like when he flips on the light switch and you see the pink walls, it's like, oh
the pink rooms.
And then the last word he says, like, oh, like
do we think the Hoyt security guy is also supposed to be gay because he tells Hayes that he has a nice body?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because that's not a thing you would say in Arkansas in 1990.
Yeah, I was like, it'd be one thing to tell him like he's fit or in shape, but nice body, that was like,
right.
Okay, so
where do you work out? Something, right, yeah.
What gross, disgusting thing do we think is happening here? So was Mamie Gummer bringing her daughter to Hoyt for like sex in the pink princess room? Was it like a sex trafficking thing? What do we think was going on in that room?
Or was she there before? Like, or was it just the day that she was abducted that she went there?
Is Hoyt actually her dad?
Well, right, because at this point there had been records that Julie's out and about. So would it even make sense that she's back in that room, right? Or is it?
And was Hoyt.
Oh.
Right? Because she, they saw her at the store.
That hadn't occurred to me.
Right? So,
oh.
So a couple things. Like, A, so the other thing we learn is that there's some other dude with a milky eye.
Right.
The other eye is milky.
Right. The other, right. So it could be that Julie had escaped Mary July and then somebody caught her before the cops did and dragged her back to the pink room, and she's on lockdown because she's been brought back. And maybe she had, so how did she disappear originally? My personal theory is that Gummer was her mother, but Hoyt was the father and took her back and, you know, like, oh, I'm going to give her a home and blah, blah, blah. But then it turns out he's like, the home is not great. And she escapes. And Gummer finds out about that, and, you know, even though she was paid off to, like, oh, I'll let my daughter live in this life of luxury rather than this terrible home with Scoot McNairy, who doesn't even love me, they get taken. The boy gets killed by someone else who has yet to be revealed.
I think the theory instantly was correct. The boy got killed accidentally, probably defending his sister.
Right.
And and sort of the mother's then reaction to all this, all of it makes sense. Obviously, it could also just be simply grief, but it's like, this was supposed to be helpful to my daughter, and now my
or
son,
both of them.
And now my son is
or
killed.
Both of them. Maybe it was right. Supposed to be both of them.
Well, here's a question: who lures them out to the woods with like the dice and the toys and all that?
Who is the black man and the white woman in the sedan?
Oh, so right. It's Mamie Gummer and the guy with the milky eye. The second milky guy. I don't know.
That guy might have also, you know, as they say, a lot of people losing fingers and eyes at Hoyt. Like, right? So maybe he was another Hoyt employee that was paid off to go and do that.
Do we think that Mavis ever wrote the second book, or is the implication?
Amelia.
Sorry.
You keep thinking her name is Mavis.
I don't know where
Who's
I got that.
Who's Mavis?
I have no idea.
That's a good question, too. Here's another question. This is what I asked you, Matt, the other night before a movie we saw. Didn't it seem like Scoot McNairy really knew his way around that house, that Hoyt mansion? Like, he knew where to find the hallway to the secret stairway, to the passageway, to the pink room. Like, how did he wasn't like looking around. He went straight for it. How does he know his way around the Hoyt mansion?
I would say
if he's been there, why would he be shocked by the pink room?
Right.
Or so, is it based shot you, by a thing that
I'll
we can't
see?
He's shot by what he sees in the pink room. Because he knows to reach in and find the light switch.
That's true.
Scoot McNairy reads scripts before he does his shoes.
I didn't get any of that.
No?
But that doesn't. You make good points. I just didn't get any of that.
I saw him
as a guy who was sort of drunk, you know, overwhelmed with emotion that, like, you know, he saw drinking again for the first time in years, right? Accused of killing his daughter, confronting at this moment. Betrayed by a man who he, although he wouldn't have had any hopes of ever being with, he sort of loves, right? I mean, the way he prayed with him, and now you look back on the way he held his hand. Like, Roland means something to him, and right. not only has he been
and
accused
Roland's
of murder,
right?
He's been betrayed by Roland, and then he overhears the cop thing and a little,
Roland was the only
British
person
show.
Who'd ever like what was reached that? Out
oh,
to
Downton
him.
Abbey.
It was a little Downton Abbey
in the hallway, and you hear all the things
all they hear you want.
Wait, you guys, do we think that he and Roland were together?
No, I don't think so. No, but I do think he loves Roland. He just feels like, you know,
was supportive, and he may have thoughts about Roland, but I don't think it.
And he has the, you know, he had the conversion thing with him. This is a guy who may not even act on his on the things that he wants. And he feels shame about it.
He'd been seen at the gay bars.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, but if he does it, it's reluctant. I imagine he goes long stretches of time without doing it and fighting himself constantly. And, I mean, he's miserable, and his life has been miserable, and he's a good person, and it's a horrible shame. But, you know, and then you're drinking for the first time, and you've been betrayed. So, I don't know. I thought he was just sort of fully motivated by the overwhelming emotion of what those last 12 hours must have been like.
Right, and I think when he shows up at the house, the security guy, who's clearly in the security room, sees, oh, he's here. I'm going to lure him to some place that I can kill him quietly and dispose of the body.
Oh, right.
Because then he'll stop looking.
Right, he'd seen him. I didn't even.
Because we got Julie back, and we need to clean up this loose end so that people stop asking, like, because if Scoot McNairy dies, then that quiets down people looking for Julie.
I suspect what we're going to, a good bet of what we're going to see then in episode 7 is Scoot McNairy like face down in a river with following Harris James, killing him and making it look like a suicide of a guy overwhelmed by guilt because he'd been he'd been found out about what he'd done to his son. And
well, let me ask you this. I can't remember, but the timelines, do we ever see or know of Scoot McNairy in 2015?
It hasn't been mentioned either way, but there's been obviously a lot of references of what we've done. So,
right,
you know,
and
we don't know
right,
what that is.
As well as like a lot of people connected with this investigation of dying.
Well, I was going to say, let's talk about the documentary filmmaker. It keeps talking about people dying and that kind of thing, and there's the whole, you know, Hayes finally confronts his son about his relationship with her in this episode, which hadn't really...
So maybe what we've done is not killing anyone. Maybe what we've done is fingered the wrong guy and got him killed, or he killed himself, and we have been carrying the weight of Scoot McNairy's death with us when we know he didn't do it.
Now we've got to make it right.
It's 1990 to 2015. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the documentary filmmaker is Julie's daughter.
No.
Wow.
No.
My mind is blown if that's indeed true.
I love the pause of it's like, what?
Anyway, so yeah, this one, it really picked up steam. Like, 4 was five was pretty good, 6 was like, wow. And so, like, the next 2 I'm really pumped about because it's picking up steam here.
And frequently with these, the next to last episode is where a lot of the plot gets resolved, and then the last episode is where a lot of the character stuff gets resolved. But with this one, who knows?
Yeah, and I think that, and I don't even know that this is true, but my belief on that is that that applies with series that go on.
As opposed to
something that's going to end
right
at after episode 8.
Anyway, we will definitely talk about episode 7 next week. So yes, this is all really exciting.
So thanks for watching. Follow us at BFest All Day on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review, or subscribe at any of the popular podcatchers. Subscribe to us here at YouTube. Leave us a thumbs up. Thanks for watching.
Thanks, guys. Bye.